CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. The New World Report with Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College. Brazil, the giant of the Americas, second only to the United States in population, first in resources and growth, and yet Brazil police accuse Bolsonaro of fraud and vaccine records, reads the Reuters headline. The background on this has to do with the pandemic and Bolsonaro, president at the time, traveling in and out of the country. And an investigation by the Comptroller General's office, reads Reuters, had found that Bolsonaro's vaccination records were falsified to suggest he was vaccinated against COVID-19 in Sao Paulo in July 21 when he was not in the city. That's the least of it. There's a series of these incidents that are inconsistent with the vaccine vaccinations. And I mentioned that this is not the only indictment or challenge or accusation pending against the former president. Also, earlier, there were two generals, now retired, of the Brazilian military who have given testimony, released suddenly. It's been in the possession of the authorities for some time, saying that in the summer before the election, Mr. Bolsonaro discussed with them a coup. The word coup is used. Why that is important is because in the Constitution in Brazil, there is a concept of state of siege, which does not have a parallel or analogy in the U.S. Constitution. Coup is used repeatedly. That is not only the detail. There's also fresh news that Mr. Bolsonaro's son is accused of laundering money during the campaign, after the campaign. In general, what we're looking at is, in other countries, called lawfare, being used against a political opponent in order to disenfranchise him. The striking fact is Mr. Bolsonaro is already disenfranchised. An earlier investigation led to him being barred from running in the next election cycle. There is the puzzle, Professor. You know, Colonel Mustard in the dining room with candlesticks. This continued persecution of Mr. Bolsonaro, what is it that the authorities hope to achieve? Because one thing they are achieving is turmoil in the population. It was a 50-50 election. Mr. Bolsonaro, I'm told, has enormous support in the large city of Sao Paulo. Brasilia is half a continent away. So how do you see this landscape of continuing to find things to accuse Mr. Bolsonaro of? And vaccination record seems extremely unusual, given that we've had revelations of the vaccine now that suggests that mandating the vaccine wasn't always wise, depending upon the population and the person. How do you see this from the point of view of Lula da Silva and his prosecutor general? What are they looking to achieve? Thank you.
Well, John, certainly there's a lot of built-up momentum, given that on the one hand, a lot of the cases, both the civil cases and the criminal cases that were initiated towards the end or shortly after the end of Bolsonaro's period in office are now kind of carrying through the courts. And certainly with a sympathetic court of the opposite party and presidency of the opposite party with respect to Lula, you know, those cases in many ways are prospering. But again, you know, so you see the cumulative effect, as you alluded to, already due to previous cases, Bolsonaro has been deemed politically ineligible to run again for president until 2030, although he continues to indicate that he wants to endorse other candidates and continue to be politically relevant. As you indicated before, you know, his entire family, not unlike what's happened in the United States with President Trump and his family. The latest, of course, Jair Renan Bolsonaro charged in a money laundering case. But also, as you alluded to, John, this, as in the United States, adds to the polarization between the right and left. If the right that supported Jair Bolsonaro with respect to guns and social values and evangelical impulses felt excluded by the kind of political correct left part of Brazilian politics. This sense of judicial persecution is further undermining their faith in the neutrality of the Brazilian legal system, not unlike the political dynamics which are occurring in the United States. But is it a deliberate plot? Probably not. But is it prospering because of the not only what's started in the system, but also a environment that's amenable to it under Lula, probably to some degree. Is it bad for Brazil and its governability and the faith of all in democracy and coexistence over the long term? Probably also. This will create pressures over the long term, reconciling right and left within a country which has traditionally been a fairly politically amiable country that's got along with respect to social conflict and political compromise.
The Brazilian situation from Lula da Silva's point of view is the economy must prosper, and there are mixed reports about that, but all of the Americas have mixed reports on the economy. Lula da Silva, however, has gone out of his way to align himself with not only left of center, but you'd say adversarial colleagues. I'm thinking of the fact that Brazil is part of the BRICS, and that includes China and Russia at the same time, and South Africa, countries that have all taken hostile approaches to the wars in Eurasia and to international agreements. So at this point, where is Brazil on the spectrum? Is it neutral like India? Is it hostile like South Africa? Is it beholden to China? Is it entertaining Russia? I can't tell. It's such a large country. I know generalizations are not successful. I'm just trying to peg it in my mind where it is in this, what right now is emerging as a quilt of powers around the world, all dancing at different tunes.
Well, John, certainly while Brazil is not Venezuela, it is not, a authoritarian, populist, Russian military welcoming, anti-U.S. state. But certainly the Lula that has come back into office after spending time in prison has come back radicalized. You've seen that in his economic policy, in his, much a greater level of statism and his commitments with respect to government programs. But especially you see it in the politics of the foreign ministry of Itamar Chi. In part, it's a legacy issue. Brazil trying to build on its traditional role as a internationally engaged middle power, trying to broker deals. And so you've seen Lula trying to insert himself unsuccessfully, probably unhelpfully in the war in the Ukraine, taking a deliberately neutral position with respect to Russia. You've seen Brazil trying to take, again, a relatively anti-Israel position in the Middle East. Really a number of positions that have been probably from a U.S. State Department standpoint unhelpful, including in regional politics. And certainly also a continuation of what you saw from the first Lula administration, trying to welcome Venezuela back into the fold and also being reluctant to criticize some of the more anti-U.S. dictators. Mentioning the Ortegas in Nicaragua, among others, and not just Nicolas Maduro. And so while Brazil, again, has not adopted a hardline anti-U.S. policy, it has done things that have been not only unhelpful with respect to regional politics, but one would say have created some risks. So, for example, it was in two separate occasions, the Brazilians that had welcomed the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, who then built on the Brazilian invitation to do other diplomacy in the region with Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua. It was the unprecedented Brazilian welcoming of the Iranian warship that Makran and its escort ship that Dina into Rio de Janeiro that began to open up Iranian reapproachment to the region at this relatively dangerous time, not only to countries like Venezuela that we've seen before, but again, for the first time, giving at least a pseudo-diplomatic opening through Brazil. And so, it's, again, while Brazil has not been Venezuela, Lula's posture in, asserting that neutrality or global relevance, it's not been globally relevant, and it's not been entirely helpful.
Argentina, Javier Milei, the man who campaigned with a chainsaw and is in a hurry. He's said to be in a hurry in order to put in reforms and tame the inflation and deliver a vision for Argentina that's different than its recent past, has run into the expected opposition in the legislation. I imagine this is about the Senate legislation for the Senate. But are there plan Bs here? He's closed ministries. He's changed the direction of what looked to be the handout culture from the Peronistas, poor people being fed marginally, now finding new ways to find for their breadlines. But the opposition in the legislature was long expected. Does he have a workaround?
Well, John, one of the key things about Argentina with all of its problems is it is constitutionally a strongly presidentialist system, even though it's also a federal system. And part of that presidentialism, you have a number of different quirky options, one of which is something called a national urgent necessity decree, which essentially allows a president with the concurrence of one house of Congress to initiate emergency actions that are then basically later considered. And only if they are if they're voted in by one house of Congress, they go into effect. They then have to be voted down by two houses of Congress in order to be essentially reversed from effect. And so a lot of what Milei has done in the early part of the presidency has been not with the legislature per se. He actually has a very weak presence in both houses of the legislature with his Libertarian Party, La Libertad Avanza. But what he's done is using presidential decrees. He's slashed government and bureaucracies. He's done a number of things to bring the fiscal house as well as the financial house back in order, dramatically slashing government spending, slashing public works programs, beginning to build up reserves, things that have won him praise from the International Monetary Fund. That's actually brought down inflation substantially. Argentina's macroeconomic numbers are showing up relatively good. I mean, also with the experienced national security minister, Patricia Bullrich, of his allied party, the pro movement, they've been able to really prevent some of the Peronist opposition from extorting or paralyzing the economy by shutting down things from the streets. And so things have been holding together. The crack in that edifice has been that the relatively inexperienced legislative coalition, a couple of weeks ago, was unable to pass through the Congress. They accidentally withdrew rather than selectively with withdrawing a part of their omnibus legislation. And now the Senate, one of two houses that has to reject the actions that Milei has taken, has basically just rejected a big part of his emergency package. So the question now becomes whether the House, which is entirely possible, could also reject it. So at the end of the day, it will undermine in part Milei's ability to do some of the things on a persistent basis that he's trying to do. But many of his changes will continue in effect. Many of the good fiscal performance and financial performance continues to be the case because that's presidential discretion. But it does highlight the degree to which his lack of legislative backing creates a problem for how quickly he can move. And also, at the end of the day, if you want to attract investors into your country, it helps to have things done by laws and not just presidential decrees, because it gives a sense of permanence to it. So it is a problem, but it's not as much of a problem yet as one seems. Milei is still arguably holding things together. And there are still hope that we'll get through this critical period of 3 months showing some signs of progress. The suffering they're going through right now, there's light at the end of the tunnel, and there's going to be something to show for continuing to go through this very difficult period of adjustment that Milei has talked about from the very beginning.
Professor Evan Ellis, U.S. Army War College. I'm John Bash.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.